You're late.
Sorry, Dominic. I'm multitasking as we record this because I've got a new job.
But I liked it when you had all your time for podcasting. What's going on?
Well, you know how my parents got a bike shop, electric bikes?
Yeah. Ah, I see where this is going. Electric bikes are one of the few businesses that's booming at the moment, thanks to COVID.
Exactly. We're in a very fortunate position as a family, but they've been busy to the extent that I've had to be drafted in this week as a receptionist. My mum hasn't had a break in weeks, so my dad's redirected the shop phone to my mobile, and I'm fielding requests. It's very exciting.
Whoa, so we might have to stop a few times in the middle of recording for you to speak to potential electric bike customers.
Hello, Whoosh Bikes. How can I help? I think I've got quite a cheery phone manner.
Well, it depends what mood you're in. how many bikes have you sold today?
None yet.
Oh.
It's only very early in the morning. Give me a minute. I'll have sold 10 by the end of the day. I'm very confident.
And how is it for your parents? Because they import them from China, don't they?
Yeah. So they're actually about to run out of stock. So get in there quick. If you're in the UK and you're thinking about getting an electric bike, try whooshbikes.co.uk. We deliver. And you might actually get me on the phone if you call this week. Who knows? Yeah, they're about to run out of stock. It's been pretty crazy.
That's nice. You've been much more productive than me. Although, actually, no. I've been learning Dutch a lot this week. So that's productive, but also really depressing because it's so hard learning a language that's not your mother tongue. I mean, I find it hard enough speaking English. Didn't you like learn French in about 3 weeks?
No, I was kind of tongue-tied for like my first 6 months living in France. And then I decided, you know what, it doesn't really matter if you make mistakes, you just have to like say stuff and hope for the best. And it's done me okay so far.
Yeah, nowadays you can write in French, it's mad.
C'est incroyable.
Ongelofelijk.
Anyway, what are we going to be talking about this week?
We're going to be talking about guidebooks to countries that don't exist anymore. This is a project that's been started up by the Italian journalist and guidebook writer Giovanni Valle. We're going to be speaking to him later on in the show. But first... Who's had a bad week, Katie?
It's been a bad week for Kazik Staszewski, a legend of Polish rock music, as I'm sure you know, Dominic.
Yeah, of course.
If you don't know Kazik Staszewski, and if you live outside Poland, you possibly don't, he is the frontman of a band called Cult, who are a really famous Polish punk band. To me, they sound a little bit like Madness, 1980s kind of punk ska vibe.
A nice Muswell Hill band where I grew up.
Are they your locals?
Yeah, I think we've talked about this before.
No, we talked about how Depeche Mode were local to me.
Yeah, and Madness are local to me. They, you know, I am driving in my car. I drive up to Muswell Hill.
Ah, that's your ends.
Yeah, I live on Muswell Hill.
You did.
I did. Anyway, sorry.
Yes.
Poland's answer to Madness.
Kind of. I'll probably get a lot of emails from Polish listeners saying that's not quite right. But anyway, yeah, so last week started as a good week for Kazik. He had a new single out. It's called Your Pain is Better Than Mine. And it was a hit. It went straight to number one on Poland's main pop music chart, which is run by Radio 3. But that is where Kazik's good week ended, because this has got to be one of the shortest stints that anyone has ever spent in the number one spot. Minutes after the chart show ended, the whole of the chart had disappeared from Radio 3's website. The station itself had taken the chart down. Now, to understand why this song was controversial in the first place, let us examine the lyrics. So basically, the song criticizes a senior unnamed political figure for giving themselves privileges under the coronavirus lockdown that other people aren't allowed. Which might sound quite familiar to British listeners who've been following the Dominic Cummings scandal.
I was going to say we should not talk about that. All the British listeners need a break.
Please, just a half hour talking about something else. The Polish song includes the lyrics, "You alone can soothe your pain. Everyone else has to suffer. Two limousines or one, the entire cemetery just for you." Now, that is a reference to a ceremony at a cemetery in Warsaw last month that took place to mark the 10th anniversary of the plane crash in Smolensk that killed the Polish president, Lech Kaczynski, and dozens of other really senior officials. We actually talked about this on the podcast a couple of weeks ago with Anya Jakubek.
And didn't Anya say the commemoration had been a bit controversial?
Yeah, exactly. So the president that got killed, his brother Jarosław Kaczynski, is now the most powerful man in Poland. He's not actually in the government, but he's the head of the ruling party, and he's kind of widely seen as the man that pulls the strings in the government. And this song is a reference to the fact that the ceremony was open so that Kaczynski could go in and pay his respects to his brother and also visit his mother's grave, which, if you're being sympathetic, is kind of fair enough, you know? Like, this was the 10th anniversary of a horrific tragedy. The man's twin brother died, and that brother was the president. But this whole thing also left a lot of people feeling like, hang on a second, why does he get to go to the cemetery and pay his respects to a lost loved one when normal people aren't getting to do that? There are lots of people who are missing lost loved ones who would really like to be able to grieve in the normal way, and they're not allowed to do that right now. So the song talked about that, and it did so with a very jaunty, fake, cheery tune. And people really liked it. It went straight to number one. But lo and behold, the radio station had taken the chart down minutes after the song shot to number one.
Do you think people who put it up to number one didn't even realise that it had this political message in it? Was it like subtle?
I don't think it was that subtle. So it doesn't name Kaczynski by name, but I think it's pretty obvious who they're talking about if you've been following Polish politics at all. So it caused a really massive scandal, and lots of people started accusing the radio station of censorship. Some really famous musicians have said they don't want their music played on the station anymore in protest, and some of its most famous hosts have quit their jobs over this. Radio 3 is run by the state, but it was generally seen as the radio station for kind of like the intelligentsia, I guess a bit like NPR in America or BBC Radio 4, that kind of thing. And under communism, it was seen as a lot more independent than other outlets. It was the only station that played music from outside the Iron Curtain. So it has this legacy. And for its fans, seeing this kind of censorship is very chilling. But it's also not unexpected. Kaczynski's party has been really turning state media into a government mouthpiece for several years now, and this is depressingly just the latest example of that. To be fair to the government, I mean, some members of the government have actually criticized this move, and it seems like it could have just been self-censorship by the radio station rather than like Kaczynski phoning them up and saying, take this song down. It seems like the radio station bosses were probably preempting that and thinking, we are going to be in a lot of trouble if this song goes out at number one. And the song is now back in the chart at number four. But the fact that it got removed in the first place is really telling of what the media climate is like in Poland these days. And that is very scary.
It reminds me a bit of when BBC decided not to play Ding Dong, The Witch is Dead after Margaret Thatcher died.
I can't quite remember. Had it actually gone to number one in the pop charts, that song?
It reached number two, which means that the BBC should be playing it in their official chart show. But I think they just decided to play a little clip of it and reported about the campaign. And that was seen as like censorship.
Who's had a good week?
It's been a good week for organic farming after the EU announced their farm to fork strategy. A very snappy name. It's a central part of their European Green Deal, which they were talking a lot about this week. But how good a week has it been for organic farming? That is a bit up in the air and seems to be dividing opinion. But shall I start by giving you a few of the top line announcements?
Do I have a choice?
No.
Okay, yes, please.
I'll only mention a few of them. But they aim to halve the use of hazardous and chemical pesticides by 2030, reduce fertilizer use by 20%. And the Commission wants to boost the development of the EU organic farming area with the aim of making 25% of total farmland organic by 2030. Maybe that doesn't sound like that much, but the latest figures we have are from 2018, and they suggest that only 7.5% of agricultural land in the EU is farmed organically. Props to Sweden, Estonia and Austria, who are currently the top three countries, sitting somewhere between 20 and 25% organic farming.
That's loads. But how do they actually define organic farming?
Yeah, maybe Maybe that's an obvious question, but maybe some people are listening and being like, oh, obviously I know that. It's defined by the use of fertilizers and pesticides that are only of organic origin. So things like manure. They make a few exceptions, allowing a few synthetic substances in, but it's mainly entirely organic. And they also don't use antibiotics in organic livestock farming, and there's no use of hormones or genetically modified things. I think we all kind of think we should buy organic products, but don't really know why. I sometimes don't buy the organic products because they're way more expensive than their non-organic equivalents. I was thinking back to when organic products started emerging in our supermarkets, and a lot of the argument was around them being more healthy for us to eat personally. And that may well be the case, but it's also one of the things that's kind of so easy to be skeptical about when you're considering buying a lemon for double the price of its toxic equivalent. Also, it's only part of the story. Organic farming is absolutely vital for saving our ecosystem, the biodiversity, and stopping our environment from heading towards destruction.
Sounds reasonable.
Broadly, organic farming tries not to disturb the balance between plants and insects and soil and animals. Another problem for industrial farming is logging and the intensive use of soil, which makes it much less likely for soil to regenerate. This is before we've even started talking about the fact that many synthetic pesticides seem to have very serious negative impacts on our health and the environment. So there's a lot that needs to be improved in our farming industries. And this shift from the EU to try to transition to more organic food is undoubtedly necessary. And the targets they've set seem to be a good start. But many environmental groups are pretty disappointed that the plans don't go further. They see these proposals as kind of incremental change as opposed to the systemic change that is required to avoid catastrophic disasters in our biodiversity and climate. One of the big areas of criticism in this plan is actually about meat farming. And according to Euroactive, a draft of this paper contained the pronouncement that the Commission would stop stimulating production or consumption of meat. This didn't make it into the final copy, though there is a statement in the proposal about promoting alternative plant-based proteins, and they have promised to look into the regulations around animal feed, which is often soya that is grown on deforested land. So for many people, it's not enough, and there are some understandable accusations that agricultural lobbyists had too much of a say in the making of this plan. But there is still a lot of good stuff there that takes us in the right direction.
Is there anything like beyond like targets? Or is it just really like vague and wishy-washy right now?
Yeah, some of the details will need to be thrashed out. It is a big plan. So we'll be keeping an eye on it and seeing how likely they are to meet these targets. Do you buy all your food organic, Katie?
No. This is bad. But during the pandemic, I've become a bit less fussy. Certainly been eating more meat again. I think it's like a comfort thing. I was getting quite good at eating way less meat before, and now I've got back into eating animals, and that is very bad. But I have got also very into vegetarian nuggets. So maybe those will become cheaper under these plans, and that'd be really nice for me.
I've actually done the opposite. I've gone my longest period without eating any meat products at all during this lockdown. And
well,
it's partly because my husband's been reading this really long book, Spillover, by David Quammen, that's about, dubbed as the book that predicted Corona, and about animal infections and the next pandemic. And he basically, yeah, he did predict that this was about to happen. And also it seems like C-word seems to spread a lot in meat factories. So
So I'm contributing to the problem. Okay, fine, you've convinced me. Bye-bye meat.
I read this really interesting piece ages ago. I can't even remember where, but that suggested that it was a mistake to market organic food as organic, and that instead they should have marketed all other food as like toxic food and organic food as just like normal food.
With big like skull and crossbones over every like packet of crisps.
Yeah.
Maybe that is a good idea.
Maybe that is the kind of like paradigm shift we need. And actually, this, as part of the EU's plan, they are also planning a standardized food labeling program that not only labels the healthiness of food, but also how sustainably the food has been produced, which I think sounds like a really good idea. Because it's impossible for us all to do research on every single item of food we buy to work out how sustainably sourced it is. Well, I thought it sounded great, but then actually I read that a guy at Friends of the Earth Europe said, yeah, putting energy efficiency labels on fridges didn't stop climate breakdown, and putting eco labels on our food won't stop ecological collapse, which is probably true, but I still think it's good.
Bit of a Debbie Downer, though. Like, you have to change small things to change big things, no?
Yeah, I agree. So yeah, good week for organic farming, I still think. And a good week in general for biodiversity, because this organic farming plan was part of the EU's biodiversity plan. And there was that big headline announcement that they're going to aim to plant 3 billion trees by 2030, which sounds like a lot to me. So yeah, there's a lot in there. We don't have time to discuss everything, but I'm cautiously optimistic that things are moving in the right direction. We've got some new patrons to thank once again. Liza, Sofina and Rich Sargent, thank you so much for joining us this week and contributing a small monthly amount to help us keep going. It really makes us able to continue making this podcast. So if you'd like to join them, then head to patreon.com/Europeans podcast.
We got a really nice email from Rich saying that he listens to our podcast while he's doing home workout sessions, which I think is amazing. I don't really think of us as like pumping workout music.
Yeah, I'm also surprised that we would be inspiring him to keep going.
He's actually not even the first person to do that. I think Aljaz, our former Slovenian guest, once said that he was doing like those 7-minute workouts with bits of the Europeans. I like it. This should be encouraged. Where are you going on your holidays this year, Dominic? Going anywhere nice?
Good question. No, I am not expecting to be going on holiday anytime soon, even as borders open. That's partly because I'm a hypochondriac, but it's also due to the fact that I don't have much money right now. And I'm sure some of our listeners will fit into at least one of those two categories. Maybe in the meanwhile, while we can't go on holiday, we should like fantasize about going on holiday by reading this new book, The Guidebook to the Republic of Venice, by our guest today, Giovanni Valle.
Yeah, so a couple of years ago, Giovanni struck upon this really rather charming idea of writing guidebooks for what he called extinguished countries. And he put the idea on Kickstarter, where it promptly raised about 25,000 euros. People love this idea. And the first book in the series is about the Republic of Venice, a country that lasted a good millennium in the Mediterranean. So we rang up Giovanni to talk about it. How on earth did you come up with this idea?
I was in Dubrovnik in Croatia. I was updating back then a mainstream guidebook about Dubrovnik, about the city. And I was speaking with my girlfriend, now wife, about the history of Dubrovnik, that has been an independent republic for centuries, the Republic of Ragusa. And about the fact that in the city back then, the most common visiting tour, let's say, was the one related to Game of Thrones, because they shot part of the series in Dubrovnik. And there was nothing about, or in any case, it wasn't popular to take a tour about the Republic of Ragusa. So what was that building back then? How did this independent republic manage to last for centuries, nested between the Ottoman Empire and the Austro-Hungarian Empire? So small, but still managed to survive. And we thought, wouldn't it be nice, you know, if instead of having this mainstream guidebooks about Croatia, Slovenia, Italy, Spain, Greece, well, you had a guidebook about a country that no longer exists. And that's how it all started, let's say.
And so the Republic of Venice is what you started with. And when exactly did that exist?
It's hard to pinpoint a date for the beginning. But in the guidebook, I kind of consider 697. And then it lasted all the way to just after the French Revolution. So 1797, that's when Napoleon comes to Italy and destroys, let's say, the Republic of Venice. Put an end to it, not military, but with a treaty. So it's more than 1,000 years. It's super long, actually. And what's interesting in the Republic of Venice is that there is a huge archive in Venice with some 80 kilometers of documents. So that's why we can know a lot about it, and it's fun to tell that story.
When you say 80 kilometers of documents, you mean sort of shelves of papers?
Exactly, yes.
Wow, that's crazy. So where exactly What land was covered by the Republic of Venice?
The Republic of Venice had territories that controlled for some periods and then lost them and then conquered some others. So I kind of consider the biggest area the Republic of Venice controlled in a steady way. So that is some parts of seven states, so northern Italy, and then the coast of Slovenia, Croatia, Montenegro, some parts of Albania, Greece, and Cyprus. But at the same time, it's fascinating because, you know, you can find the same architecture in Bergamo in northern Italy and in Greece. That's very far away, but there is this cultural connection.
And are you expecting readers to actually make holidays around this guidebook? Could you imagine that someone might take this book and think, okay, I'm actually going to explore this country that doesn't exist anymore?
Well, I hope so. And I think there are some parts in which it can really work. You know, for example, you can go from Venice to Slovenia, to Croatia and Montenegro, and that's a feasible tour, let's say, by car, or the best would be by boat. We're trying to organize that in September with a friend, with a sailboat. But it is indeed the goal, let's say, of these guidebooks, to show you that you can go beyond borders and still follow a cultural thread that makes sense. Also to question a bit today's borders, you know, to realize that the states we know are a recent creation. They have not been there forever. Now we speak a lot about, of course, the pandemic and the virus. But when I started thinking about this, the main topic as a journalist that I was dealing with was nationalism, the rise of nationalism in Europe. And that's why this project interests me so much.
So obviously, in your guidebook, you don't list hotels or restaurants, but I think you do talk about food, don't you? And I was wondering if you could tell us about one of your favorite dishes that still today can be found in the different regions that once were part of the Republic of Venice.
There is a dish called, in Italian, it's called brodetto. In Croatian, it's called brudet. And in Greek, it's called burdetto. It's a fish stew. It's in Croatian, in Italy, it's more of a soup. And in Greece, as far as I understood so far, it's more of a stew, so with less liquid and more solid. And it's a dish that you can find with almost the same name in these three countries. Another one is this pastizzada in Croatian, pastissada in Italy, actually only in Verona, as far as I understood, and pastizzado in Greece. In Verona is horse meat and polenta. In Croatia is beef and gnocchi as a side dish. And in Greece is beef again, but with spaghetti. And of course, everyone thinks it's the local dish, but it's also a bridge that connects to an island far away where they do it, but in a different way.
How did you avoid falling into the trap of writing a guidebook that might seem nostalgic or celebrating this past republic?
Well, that was a huge question we had to tackle at the beginning. But the solution was quite easy, actually. I am interviewing local experts. So every time when I'm speaking about the Venetian past of, let's say, Zadar, the city of Zadar, I go there or I contact someone there, try to find the best historian. The idea is to have somebody who will tell the local perspective, so the point of view of that city. And that is a way to avoid telling the story of the Venetians, like how Venice tells the story. Because for Venice, of course, I mean, they're very proud of it. And many people in Veneto might consider it as a great historical moment, maybe emphasizing too much the democratic aspects of it. The oligarchy was in power. There was no mass voting or democratic rights as we know them today. On the other side, people in Greece complain about the Venetian fleet once bombing the Parthenon, for example. People in Dalmatia have other complaints. And what is beautiful for me as a journalist is to cross all those stories and put them together in the guidebook, so to show the different point of view. And yeah, the way we decided to do that is by having local interviews.
So this is, in theory, the first in a series of guidebooks. What other extinguished countries do you want to produce guidebooks for?
I'm very much interested in at least the European territories of the Ottoman Empire. The Austro-Hungarian Empire is another one that I would like to do. But then I'm very curious about non-European extinguish countries, because I studied diplomacy in Europe, in Italy and in France. I don't know much about countries that existed, for example, in Africa before European colonization. And I'm sure those kingdoms and countries have a lot to tell and might be very interesting to travel Africa going beyond the borders that we know today, for example. The list is endless.
The first book in Giovanni's series of guidebooks for extinguished countries is available for pre-order now. We'll put a link in the show notes. That's going to be out at the end of the year. What are you reading or watching in the meantime, Dominic? What's your isolation inspiration this week?
This is a bit of a naughty one because it's actually American, but they were talking about PewDiePie, the Swedish YouTuber, so I thought I might get away with that. I've been listening to this podcast series from the New York Times called Rabbit Hole, which is about YouTube, and it is brilliant. You've been listening too, haven't you?
I have, and I think it can be justifiably recommended as a European recommendation, because there's also that they interview that former French YouTube executive.
Oh yeah, of course.
Who was really like responsible for building the algorithm that just like keeps us all hooked to YouTube, like little addicted bunny rabbits.
And in our own little filter bubbles.
The way I explained it when I was at YouTube at the time was...
Say hi to everybody!
When you watch a cat video... Then the recommendation engine can say, oh, you watch the cat video, so we are going to give you another cat video. And then another cat video. And then another cat video.
He does feel bad about it now.
He does, that's true. What have you been enjoying?
I've got another audio recommendation for you this week. Our friends at RB Europe have produced a beautiful audio project by the musician and storyteller Francesca Vincenti about her roots in Sweden and Indonesia and the Netherlands. And it's just a really beautiful piece of audio. You should just let it wash over you.
Like rows of stars in the dark sky on a clear night, the dinghies slowly made their way closer and closer to the mothership. Havet låg så orört då, en spegelblankt utan kron.
It's got lovely visuals too. I thoroughly recommend it.
Yeah, the illustrations are amazing. Time for a happy ending. For my happy ending this week, I'm going back to farming, I'm afraid. I'm a one-trick pony today, or a one-trick cow, seeing as the thing I'm happy about is cows. Because a Swiss biotech firm have invented a pill that seems to reduce the nasties that cows fart and burp out by about 30%.
When you say nasties, you mean like greenhouse gases?
Yeah, I mean methane, really. I think by now we all know that cows burping and farting is incredibly bad for our environment, is one of another reason why we should all probably be becoming vegan. But did you know that if cows were a country, they would be the sixth most polluting country in the world?
Wow, that is wild.
Well, something that could help that is this new pellet, which has been invented by a firm with a wonderful name, Mootral. And I'm not convinced, I mean, maybe it's not meant to be pronounced like that, but that's how I read it. Mootral.
Is that how they answer the phones?
Hello, Mootral. So they've invented a pellet that's made out of garlic, citrus and a bunch of other additives. Ironically, it apparently smells a bit like fart, according to the New York Times article. But some peer-reviewed studies showed really encouraging results. And the studies are ongoing in the Netherlands, the US and England, where there's a farm that has become the first dairy farm to explicitly market their milk as climate friendly. Their bottles are labeled with a sticker that says less CO2W burps on the side. They also think that maybe the reduction in farting leads to more milk production. This hasn't been confirmed, but some scientists are theorizing that they're able to produce more milk because they're burping and farting less. It's a good lesson for us all.
Is it?
Anyway, Mootrell could also make a lot of money out of this, so it's definitely a very happy ending for them once all the research has been completed and they're selling their stinky pellets by the million. But regardless of the fat cats who will be benefiting from this financially, I think we could all potentially benefit from this if they help reduce emissions. So happy ending for the cows to fart and burp freely, just less toxically.
Some of our listeners, Dominic, would have been hoping for an hour-long special this week on Eurobonds from you. They'll have been very disappointed. What happened?
Yeah, we did promise it last week. The name's Bonds, Eurobonds. But I listened to a few podcasts myself about Eurobonds, and also particularly about this new German constitutional court ruling against Europe's quantitative easing program. And I just decided I wasn't really up to the job. I found it hard enough listening to experts, constitutional law experts, talk about it all. So I actually thought instead I would just recommend some other podcasts. One of our Patreon supporters, was it Maeve?
Yeah, it was Maeve.
Maeve recommended a podcast from the Irish Times called Inside Politics. They had an episode on this ruling that could shake up the EU, and it's called How a Legal Challenge Could Unravel the EU. Pretty bold title, but give it a listen if you want to find out more. And you're probably all grateful that I didn't try and take on this mammoth topic.
I still think the more the merrier. You should give it a go next week.
No, it's not happening.
Spend the whole week learning about constitutional law and financial mechanisms.
I was too busy learning Dutch.
Next week. In the meantime, you can find us on a range of social media platforms. We are on Twitter at EuropeansPod, Instagram at EuropeansPodcast, Facebook, if you just type in the Europeans Podcast, you'll find us. And we always put our email address here, even though it's not a social media platform. I'm going to say it anyway. Send us an email at hello@EuropeansPodcast.com.
Tot de volgende keer.
What?
That means till the next time.
Oh, nice. Yeah, what he said.